Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Today, mourners from across the nation gathered in Washington, D.C. to pay their respects and celebrate the life of former President George H.W. Bush at a state funeral at Washington National Cathedral. He was America's 41st president. He was eulogized as a patriot, statesman, father, loyal friend, husband, and grandfather. As a political scientist, my focus is not on who he was personally, but what were the policy outputs that came from his administration. To assist me with this analysis is my first guest. He's a PhD student in the Department of Communication, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University School of Communication. He's been a TV news reporter for more than 20 years as a senior Washington, D.C. correspondent. Since 2008, he's also been a reporter at large covering two presidencies, Congress, and State Departments. He is Colin Campbell. Colin, as always, man, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks, Dr. Leon. Appreciate it.
So as we watched, well, as we've been going through these last 3 days, we've heard so much about President George H.W. Bush. We've heard about Sully, his companion dog. We've heard all of these things. But let's talk about policy. When you think about George H.W. Bush, the administration and the policy, what comes to mind?
Yeah, there was a lot of pomp and circumstance today, wasn't there? But what I think of when I think of H.W. Bush is some of the more controversial campaigning strategies that he had, especially the racialized strategies. But I do want to put in context, I don't want to speak all negatively about the former president. He did pass a lot of domestic legislation, I believe more than any other president except Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt. So he did have some positive aspects with his accomplishments as far as domestic policy, especially when it came to the Clean Air Act, the ADA, which was very influential with how we access our buildings every day. And I think that he was widely lauded for that support. He also had the 1990 Farm Bill and the 1991 Civil Rights Act. Now, of course, before the Civil Rights Act, he had turned down jobs legislation, a Jobs Act. But with the Civil Rights Act, it was supposed to act against discrimination and job harassment. But at the same time, he banned quotas. Now, of course, that's a controversial standpoint. But if the point was to help build a level of equity and comity across the American public, some people would say that that 1991 Civil Rights Act actually fell a little bit short, trying to create job equality for everyone, especially including African Americans in this country. So that has to be scrutinized, and it can't be ignored. At the same time, we have to remember the Iran-Contra affair as well, which was highly controversial, where he made several pardons. Many believed, pundits say, that he did that to protect himself and some of the scandals that were involved in that, selling arms to the Sandinistas. So even that can be scrutinized as well. But if you take a more moderate approach, looking at some of his policies, many would say that he did have a knack for going across the aisle and making deals, something that seems to be very far away from the strategies of our Congress of today. So he's definitely being praised for his accomplishments back then, the way he was able to make deals. He was able to come to some type of compromise, especially on his legislative successes, like the Clean Air Act. But at the same time, we have to remember when he ran against the caucus, when they used that very racialized ad featuring Willie Horton, when they talked about furloughs and how he was let out on a furlough and he ended up raping a woman and attacking and assaulting the woman's husband. And he used that as an ad to scare the public. And we kind of can see that in one of our more recent candidates, can't we? Use a boogeyman to try to persuade the public into voting a certain way. But he did use this tactic, and he won. And this is in spite of the fact that Reagan, the president he served under as vice president, signed similar legislation for furloughs of convicted criminals. So that's something that definitely the African-American population cannot forget, especially when it comes to political strategies, creating boogeymen out of members of the African-American population.
You know, what's interesting when you mention Willie Horton, and it was, of course, his campaign chairman, Lee Atwater, that introduced, well, the whole historical context is that Al Gore is the one who introduced the furlough program into the conversation, but Al Gore did not mention Willie Horton. It was Lee Atwater and George H.W. Bush that introduced us to Willie Horton. One of the interesting ironies in that conversation is that Roger Stone, who is now, of course, the ally of Donald Trump, told George, quote, you told Lee Atwater, quote, you and George Bush will wear that to your grave. He complained to Atwater, told Atwater it was a racist ad and you're going to regret it. And Lee Atwater, on his deathbed, apologized for using Willie Horton against Dukakis, but George H.W. Bush never did.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that was definitely back when he had a very close relationship with Roger Ailes and James Baker, who took on this very dark tone when it came to campaigning, a very, very aggressive, negative style of campaigning that still holds to this day, because many people point to that fact, even though it may have been an egregious way to politicize Willie Horton. Some people look back at that era and say this negative style of campaigning was successful for H.W. Bush to win over Dukakis, and it's still prevalent today. If we look around the landscape, especially in the midterm elections, we could see some of this negative campaigning is definitely harkens back to that time, and I believe that, yeah, like you said, Lee Atwater, James Baker, and Roger Ailes really contributed to this negative type of campaigning strategy. And again, something else that they did, I remember, was the questioning of patriotism, which also is very reminiscent of not too long ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
2016, so long ago. But back then, they questioned Dukakis' patriotism when Dukakis really had an issue with the mandatory Pledge of Allegiance in schools. And Bush, H.W. Bush, number 41, really questioned Dukakis' patriotism and said, well, what does he have against the Pledge of Allegiance? Why can't they say it in schools? Not really looking at that separation of church and state and looking at the Constitution as more of a purist, he kind of injected some of his own personal feelings, especially when it came to religion, into that decision. But again, it worked for him. So a lot of people point to that and say, you know, he was a winner. He had to use that. That will be very debated as well.
You know, as I look at his involvement in Iran-Contra, I think it was 6 pardons that he gave in Iran-Contra. As I look at, for example, how he misled the American public into supporting his foray into the Gulf, for the Gulf War, where he at one point was citing top secret satellite images or citing reports of top secret satellite images. Pentagon is estimating 250,000 Iraqi troops and 1,500 tanks on the border between Iraq and Kuwait. And then later, someone from the St. Petersburg Times, I think it was Jean Heller, got her own satellite imagery and found that there weren't any troops and there weren't any tanks. So the misleading information, the misinformation, the disinformation. Then I sat back and thought, I said, you know what? He's an American president. And this is what they do. It's not unique to George H.W. Bush. His son did it. Barack Obama did it. Bill Clinton did it. This is what presidents of imperialist hegemons do.
Yeah, and it's very important to remember that during that war, the Persian Gulf War, 91, that continued airstrike.
Yes.
A U.S.-led airstrike on an Iraqi air raid shelter killed at least 48 Iraqi civilians during that time. And this is after a campaign where they dropped more than 88,000 bombs. Or 88,000 tons of material in that area. So that's why, if you take a very stark contrast, they would say that all the presidents that we've had in the last several years, including H.W. Bush, would be considered war criminals because of this. And so while you have some that would definitely revere him and his legacy as being a very strong patriot, one who was for, led humanitarian efforts and was for the people and defended the country, you'll definitely have those who will aver that he was definitely a war criminal because of the number of casualties in the Persian Gulf War and such a large amount of bombing material that was dropped in that area that left very lasting impacts for years to come. So this is a very serious thing that I think that a lot of people will criticize the president over, even now that they say you shouldn't speak ill of the dead. This is still part of his legacy.
And it's interesting, Alan Simpson spoke today, former senator. He didn't mention this. His son, George W., number 43, nobody mentioned any of this today during the state funeral. There's been reference to him as being the last member of the great generation that will be president of the United States. What are your thoughts? And for those who don't know, that those who came of age during World War II are considered to be the greatest generation. Is that having an impact on our policy? The fact that those individuals from my parents' generation, those individuals are now passed?
Yeah, I really think it does. When you look back at that era, when you talk about the reverence and respect that certain individuals had for the presidency and had a certain decorum of regalness to their position, I think this is one of the things and one of the issues where you'll see that there's a difference between the presidents of the past and the presidents that we may see into the future, where there was a little bit more of a stoicism to their presence in the office, a certain grittiness, but also with a side of compassion. At least when you talk about H.W. Bush, there seemed to be a level of compassion when it came to domestic issues. Now, of course, this can't be separated from the constant civil rights issues that needed to be addressed that were ignored to some degree. Even though the president did sign some legislation, he even admitted there needed to be further legislation. There needed to be more efforts. But because of the politicization during that time, I don't think that he went forward. So it almost depends on the perspective in which you view the president. There was an article today about how America would miss WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And I think if you view the president through that spectrum, being a member of the great generation, the greatest generation, that you could become nostalgic to that degree, almost like the voters who really who voted in droves for the current president, kind of going back to that era of the 1950s and 1960s, where to them things seemed a lot more, the environment seemed a lot more beneficial to them than it may seem like today. But if you view it in the perspective of what black people were facing during that time, Latinos were facing during that time, during H.W. Bush's presidency, during an era of increased mass incarceration, this was not, they would not really equate him to the greatest generation. They would say it's a generation, he was part of a generation that was probably yet to be desired or yet to be coveted because of the neglect of the issues that they felt were important to them.
You know, Abraham Lincoln is famous for talking about the angels of our better nature. George H.W. Bush talked about the thousand points of light that each of us could become one of 1,000 points of light, talking about the ideals of America, what America is supposed to be. But when you look at the policies implemented by the H.W. Bush administration, by the Clintons, by his son, 43, we don't see that same, we hear the rhetoric all the time, but the legislation, the policy falls woefully short.
That's right. I mean, of course, like I said before, this is a new era in our presidency. You can tell that there seems to be almost a contrasting opposing method to the way that the current president runs his administration and the way that H.W. Bush really wanted to run his. Even though he was a one-term president, many people, again, would say that when the time came to it, he really tried to work with those who politically opposed him traditionally. And during that 1,000 Points of Light speech, he talked about trying to get his whole cabinet and his whole administration involved in trying to improve the conditions of America. And if you look at the president we have today, for example, he keeps a very close circle, and even that is dwindling. And there seems to be a level of distrust, one-way loyalty from this current president, and you really didn't have that feeling during the H.W. Bush's administration. There seemed to be more of a feeling of trust throughout his administration and a mutual respect. And I think that's what's currently missing from today. Even with President Obama, you had no drama Obama. You didn't have a lot of these members of his administration facing scandals, facing rebuke, leadership under dubious methods and notions. And I think, again, when people look back at H.W. Bush, they'll say, you know, that was not, you know, you can't really compare, say, Obama and H.W. Bush on that level, but it's definitely decreased in comparison to the president we have today.
Colin Campbell, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
You got it, Dr. Leon. Talk to you soon.
My man. Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Rashida Tlaib to lead congressional delegation to Palestine's occupied West Bank. Is this an encouraging signal that some strength and backbone could be coming to the U.S. Congress as it relates to U.S. policy toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? Well, for insight into this, let's turn to my next guest. He's a writer and activist born and raised in Jerusalem, driven by a personal family tragedy to explore Palestine, its people, and their narrative. He's written a book about his journey called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He has also written Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, a frequent voice on this program. And I am honored to be able to say a friend, Miko Peled. Miko, as always, man, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thank you.
So, Democratic Representative-elect Rashida Tlaib is planning to lead a congressional delegation to the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The trip is described as a swift rebuke of a decades-old tradition for newly elected members, a junket to Israel sponsored by the educational arm of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC, the powerful pro-Israel lobby. First, talk a bit about this junket. Most folks probably don't realize that for years, newly elected members of Congress were flown to Israel and indoctrinated on a position that is pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian.
Actually, it goes a lot farther than that. I mean, they invite anybody who has the potential of becoming a decision maker. So they invite the members of city council, even in small cities across America, to these junkets. They invite anybody they possibly can. We know about police chiefs from every city in America get invited to this junket. Some is organized by AIPAC, like you said. Others are organized by ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is a big supporter of Israel. Of course, it's one of the Israeli watchdogs in America. And so this is a very, very well-oiled machine that makes sure that anybody who gets to a position of any kind of influence, even to the point we're talking about the city council members of small cities in America, get this junket. And it's a very expensive junket. It's a wonderful trip. I remember at one point somebody who was invited showed me the itinerary. But that's to make sure that they know how wonderful Israel is and that they know where they need to vote and who they need to support on this issue.
Now, Talib, the first Palestinian-American woman to be elected to Congress, said that her group will focus on issues like Israel's detention of Palestinian children, education, access to clean water, and poverty, and they may take a trip to her grandmother's village. She wants her delegation to humanize Palestinians, provide an alternative perspective to the one AIPAC pushes, and highlight the inherent inequality of Israel's system of military occupation in Palestinian territories, which Talib likens to what African Americans in the United States endured in the Jim Crow era. And I'll also add that former South African President Nelson Mandela, as well as Bishop Desmond Tutu, compared to apartheid in South Africa.
And apartheid leaders in South Africa, by the way, as a source of pride, used to compare Israel to themselves in the 1960s, even before the 67 conquest of the West Bank. Even in those days, apartheid leaders themselves, white apartheid leaders, would say, look, Israel is an apartheid regime just like us, as a source of, you know, like a kindred spirit, a kindred soul.
And even a supported soul, because Israel supported the South African government for a number of years.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So I just wanted to point out the contrast between what Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is going to be exposing members to compared to what AIPAC is indoctrinating members of Congress into. And so, first of all, it'll be very interesting to see who and how many members of Congress join Congresswoman Tlaib to elect Tlaib's group.
A delegation. Look, I there are several issues here. First of all, it's commendable. I think it's absolutely wonderful that she, at the same time, endorses BDS, the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. She is a Palestinian, and she's declaring she's not going to go on the AIPAC junket. She is going to take her own delegation. Now, having identified herself as a politician, as a public figure who supports BDS, there is an Israeli law which prohibits her from entering. So whether or not they allow her to even enter is a very interesting question. I think that's a challenge that she's putting to the Israeli authorities. Will they tell a member of the United States House of Representatives that she cannot come in because, number one, she's a Palestinian, and they don't want Americans of Palestinian heritage to come in, and number two, she declared publicly that she supports BDS, and number three, she's taking a delegation, obviously, to see the wrong, you know, in quotation marks, the wrong things. She wants to show Palestinians. So this is not a simple matter. It's not like she declared it and she can go tomorrow. I'm sure there are a lot of hurdles that are going to be put in her way. And I think as people who support her, we need to do two things. We need to make sure we support her and we're behind her. And I think we need to make sure that we keep her feet to the fire, so she does not back down either from her declaration and her support of BDS and her refusal to go with AIPAC and her determination to take as a Palestinian, host a delegation of members of the House of Representatives to Palestine, which, of course, is very fitting. You know, as a Palestinian, this is Palestine. It's her homeland. And I would add one more thing that I would hope that she would make sure to show them that Palestine is actually from the river to the sea. It is not just a couple of little villages and towns in the West Bank and Gaza, but Palestine is the entire country from the River Jordan in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west, from the Galilee in the north to the Mekab Desert in the south. Palestinians live and suffer over the entire country from the very same racist apartheid laws and the very denial of rights and water and freedoms and so forth. So I think it's a blessed, it's a wonderful initiative that she's taken, and I think we should all applaud her and make sure that she does it and succeeds.
Explain why your use of that term, from the river to the sea, is not the terrorist battle cry that has been charged against Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill for having used that language last week in a UN Palestinian Day protest that he spoke at.
Well, Palestine exists from the river to the sea. Those are the boundaries of Palestine, from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea. That's the reality. What the Zionists are doing is they've created this reality where if you mention that, if you use that, then somehow you're automatically guilty of some kind of desire to commit genocide against Jews or something ridiculous. You know, Stephen Salaita, Professor Stephen Salaita, just tweeted yesterday, I think. He says, the phrase "from the river to the sea" doesn't connote the hypothetical genocide of Israelis. It describes an area in which Israel has been performing an actual ongoing genocide of Palestinians. So they always create this impression that, number one, this means, you know, we're going to keep, you know, somebody, whoever talks like that, whoever uses the phrase, wants to kill Jews. Number two, they completely deny the fact that that is Palestine, and there has been a genocide, an ethnic cleansing, and an apartheid regime being enforced on the Palestinians who live in Palestine within those boundaries for a very long time by Israel. But this is a strategy that's worked for them very, very well. You know, they respond with their hysteria, and everybody from CNN to Fox to everybody on Facebook and all the Friends of Israel groups that are out there, you know, respond with this nonsense of that somehow this is a genocidal cry. Those are the boundaries of Palestine. And by the way, when there were opportunities to define Palestine slightly differently in the context of a two-state solution, which was done once at the end of 1947 with a partition plan, and then later on after 1967 with a two-state solution, which was kind of a partition of Palestine into two states, Israel destroyed those. Whereas Israel created the reality that there is no other way to call Palestine but by its original boundaries, which are from the river to the sea, from the Galilee in the north to the Mekab Desert in the south.
We are right now talking with Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He's also written Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. He's an activist and a regular participant in this program. Democratic Senator Ben Cardin is trying to make a behind-the-scenes push to slip an anti-boycott law into a last-minute spending bill being finalized during this lame duck session of Congress. And the measure is known as the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act, which would make it illegal for Americans to discuss the BDS movement. Do you see the action by Ben Cardin? Do you see the action by some New England police departments who have canceled a trip to Israel? Do you see Rashida Tlaib's actions as actual evidence that the BDS movement is having an impact?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. They are terrified of BDS. I think that the move by police headquarters, the police force that you mentioned, not to go to be trained by Israel is an important one. It's a courageous one. The call by the Congresswoman-elect to go to Palestine and to host, you know, to host a delegation as a Palestinian in Palestine is commendable. And in contrast, this shameful, cowardly attempt to try to pass a law that is unconstitutional, basically, because there is this thing in America called the First Amendment, in the lame duck session, just shows what a cowardly type of politician he is, and the other supporters, like Chuck Schumer, who support this law, support this bill. And I doubt that he's going to be successful. But, I mean, certainly there's a massive change taking place, a massive change and a very important change taking place in America. I mean, we shouldn't be complacent. We need to keep our efforts, make sure we do more of what we've been doing so far to get this far. But you see this courageous outpouring of support for the Palestinian cause, for the Palestinian call to impose boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel. And you contrast that with this cowardly law, this unconstitutional bill, and a cowardly way by which they are trying to pass it. It's not hard to see, you know, you check with your values, and it's not really hard to see where we should stand, who we should support here.
Congresswoman-elect Rashida Tlaib is also joined in her efforts by incoming Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, who became actually the first to publicly endorse BDS in terms of members of Congress. Do you see a faction developing within the Democratic Party, as small as this faction may be, a very vocal faction, that could push established Democratic leadership closer to a truly progressive position as it relates to U.S. foreign policy towards the Palestinians?
I certainly hope so. I really think that that's where this is. I really think that if that's where this is going, it's a wonderful thing. It's a big step in the right direction. I will say also, we talked about this last time, when I came back from the UK Labour Party conference. I think I mentioned to you that it was like sitting in a pro-Palestinian rally. There were over 10,000 people in the hall, and almost everybody was carrying a Palestinian flag. All the main speeches talked about Palestinian rights. And Jeremy Corbyn talked about halting the weapon arms sales to Israel and demanding that Israel be held accountable to the detention and imprisonment of children and political prisoners and so forth. If they can do this in the UK Labour Party, if they can bring that kind of a progressive spirit there, then there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do it here in the United States. And I think that these two particular new members of Congress showed clearly that you can be progressive on this issue and get elected. And Bernie Sanders, at the time when he was debating Hillary Clinton, he came out very strong against Israel's attack against Gaza, and that didn't hurt him one bit. In other words, even, you know, mm-hmm. know that had he not capitulated at the last minute, he may well have been president right now. So I think this is an important lesson to all politicians, and it's an important lesson to those who support the racism and the apartheid and the violence, that it's time for them to pack their bags and leave, or it's time for them to join this new wave and support justice and support the right thing.
So what is it in closing that you want my audience to understand? How do they get behind this movement? What types of support do you believe will be the most effective in terms of communicating a message of solidarity and demanding that American policy must shift? For example, as they're voting on making this $38 billion over 10 years, sending U.S. taxpayer dollars to Israel, $38 billion over 10 years, they're trying to make that law.
Well, I would tell the listeners to make sure that they inform their members, their elected representatives, that anybody who votes for that law will not get their vote next time. I think it's crucial to go to the bdsmovement.org website and read and understand it well, understand what the aims are, what the goals are, what the campaigns are, how you can help. And, you know, you go to your local store, and when they sell, you know, Sabra hummus or whatever it is, all kinds of Israeli products, to make sure that you're not okay with that because there's a call for boycott on Israeli goods. So there are a lot of things that people can do, but the important thing is that we all do, that we all get up and do something. Don't expect somebody else to do it for us. Because the question is, you know, it's about justice, freedom, and equality. If we believe in these three things and we want to see them happen for Palestinians, then we're going to have to make them happen. And they're not going to happen on their own. Just like what you said at the opening here, you know, blacks in America had to fight and are still fighting. And there's no moment, there's no time to rest. And I think you probably know, I may have mentioned it, that yesterday, I believe, was the day that Fred Hampton was murdered.
Yes.
So can you imagine, he was 22, can you imagine if he was alive today, what kind of a force of nature he would have been politically?
Absolutely.
It's important that we all remember these things and that we all keep fighting it, that we all stand and act.
Well, to your point, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. So, Miko Peled, thank you so much for your time today, so much for your insight, and you're always available when you're called to the critical hour. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. All right, folks, you are listening to the critical hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Back in October, President Trump confirmed that the U.S. will leave an arms control treaty with Russia dating from the end of the Cold War that has kept nuclear missiles out of Europe for three decades. It's the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF, which banned ground-launched nuclear missiles with ranges from 500 kilometers to 5,500 kilometers, or kilometers, as many would say. Signed by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, it led to nearly 2,700 short and medium-range missiles being eliminated and an end to a dangerous standoff between U.S. Pershing and cruise missiles and Soviet SS-20 missiles in Europe. Yesterday, the United States delivered Russia a 60-day ultimatum to come clean about what Washington alleges is a violation of the Arms Control Treaty, saying that Moscow can only save the pact. What's really behind this? For this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Welcome back, Daniel, to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So it's being reported that NATO allies led by Germany are pressing U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at a meeting in Brussels to give diplomacy a final push before Washington pulls out of the 1987 INF treaty, fearing that this could launch a new arms race. What's going on here?
Well, I think that John Bolton is having an impact on administration policy. He's a fiercely anti-Russian and fiercely and skeptical of arms control in general, and the INF treaty is to him a very tempting target. So I think he is taking aim and hitting his target.
So as I understand this now, NATO foreign ministers, they agreed to formally declare Russia in material breach of the treaty in a statement in support of the U.S. after Pompeo briefed them at the alliance headquarters in Brussels on alleged Russian violations and on Trump's stated aim to withdraw from it. Donald Trump is known for making misleading statements and also making proclamations that are baseless. So where's the evidence?
I think there's every reason to be skeptical, every reason. I can't say Trump is wrong. I can't say the charges are wrong, but there's every basis for skepticism. First of all, no one really has actually seen the missile in question. This is all based on calculations, guesses, suppositions, et cetera. It's unclear exactly what kind of technical concerns are being brought to bear here. And secondly, of course, the source is so suspect. I mean, Trump, Pompeo, and Bolton. These are three guys on the warpath. And all highly skeptical of arms control, and so the source is extremely suspect. So I think there's every reason to doubt what the U.S. is saying. I can't say that the U.S. is actually lying, but I think there's every reason to be suspicious.
Now, Russia denies undertaking such development. And to your point, Bolton is the National Security Advisor. He's a longstanding opponent of arms control treaties. So are we looking at another similar Iran deal here that President Trump comes in saying Iran's violated, every entity and agency that goes through verifying compliance, every compliance agency has said, no, they're pretty much doing what they subscribe to do. So are we looking at another type of Iran problem?
I think that, as I said, there's every reason to suspect we are. I mean, I can't say conclusively, but there's every reason for us to doubt what this unholy trio of Trump, Pompeo, and Bolton are saying. I mean, these people are unreliable in the extreme. So therefore, I think there's, you know, we should be on guard, highly suspicious, and inclined to believe there's a, you know, there's a hidden agenda here.
Thank you very much for teeing up my next question. So if we look at a hidden agenda or a longer-term plan, could this be not so much a fear of Russia and Russia's alleged development of a cruise missile? Could this be more Bolton wanting to untie America's hands as it deals with China in the Pacific? Go ahead.
And, well, it's difficult to say. I mean, there really is a three-way contest here. I mean, certainly Bolton wants to move the U.S. into a much more aggressive posture. No doubt about that. And it's really ironic that Trump, who's seen as being soft on Russia, has actually been far more aggressive than certainly the Obama administration in opposing Russia. And the China question is really interesting because China is not a party to the INF Treaty, and therefore the U.S. has complained that that the accord with Moscow gives Beijing a free hand to develop as many missiles in this category as it wishes. But there's reason to doubt that explanation as well, because the INF Treaty only covers land-based treaties. It does not cover sea or air-based missiles.
Okay.
And as you know, I mean, the contest with China is in the Eastern Pacific, where land-based missiles are not very useful, obviously, and air and sea-based missiles, launched missiles, are much more relevant.
Isn't there a broader U.S. plan in terms of trying to restrict China, to encompass China with U.S. missile capability? So
yes, but those are mostly air and sea launched.
Okay,
not land.
Okay,
and so it's hard to see how U.S. Actions against China are in any way limited by the INF Treaty, because it's irrelevant as far as the Eastern Pacific is concerned. It seems to me just sort of part of an increasingly aggressive posture that's being pushed by Bolton and Pompeo and the allegedly pro-Putin Trump. And they're just simply moving the U.S. into a much more aggressive posture, and it's a very dangerous direction they're taking this country in.
So President Putin said today that Russia will develop missiles now banned under the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty if the U.S. exits the agreement and starts making such weapons. He also has accused the United States of blaming Russia for violations as a pretext for Washington to exit the pact. Now, that goes right back to what you said at the very opening. It really seems as though President Putin here is speaking more truth than fiction. If those statements that he made are true, I can't argue his logic without seeing any evidence of Russian violation from the Trump administration.
Yes, of course. And in a certain respect, I think that the real target here may be the Europeans, who have the most to lose if there's a return to intermediate range missiles, who are most threatened, and who the U.S. seems to be absolutely contemptuous of. So it's the whole thing is a sort of strange and unclear, but certainly the one thing that comes through is the U.S. is becoming increasingly aggressive and bellicose all around, towards Russia, towards China, and contemptuous of the Europeans as well.
We're talking with journalist and author Daniel Lazar. So, Daniel, it was reported that NATO allies led by Germany are pressing the United States to engage in diplomacy, but also it's reported that NATO foreign ministers are agreeing to formally declare Russia in material breach. So what game are the NATO foreign ministers playing here, and where is it to their advantage to back the U.S. play? Because if something were to break out, Europe is going to suffer the immediate implications or repercussions of any action.
Yes, of course. But Europe is coming apart at the seams. The EU is at war with itself. There are all kinds of nationalist tendencies unleashed in Europe, and the NATO foreign ministers want to keep the U.S. in NATO, so therefore they will do anything they can to appease Trump. The famous thing that NATO was formed to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in.
Mm-hmm.
So the NATO foreign ministers want to appease Trump. They want to keep him in. They want to meet him at least halfway, while at the same time not abandoning the INF treaty altogether. And then there are certain rebellious elements even inside NATO as well. So the whole thing is a crazy hodgepodge. But the important point is that this one important arms accord, the structure is falling apart, and that's very dangerous.
So where is American political pushback? Where is American political outrage on what I call Donald Trump smoking at the gas station? Because this, as you have said a couple of times in this conversation, is a very, very dangerous game of chicken to play. So is it that because Russia has been vilified to the degree that it has been, that American politicians who would seem to be coming to the defense of Russia, if that was the spin that they put on it, are sharpening the swords for their own death?
Yes, yes. Essentially, yes. I agree totally. I mean, the Democrats have played a very dangerous game of trying to out-hawk Trump when it comes to Russia. They've accused Trump of being soft on Russia continuously since before he took office, and the only result has been sort of kind of maneuver Trump into an ever more hawkish position. So the Democrats, are part of this pas de deux, which is resulting in this increasingly dangerous atmosphere. And certainly the Democrats are therefore in no position to criticize Trump for doing away with the INF treaty. There really is no opposition. I mean, Trump has the field to himself. And whatever criticism he faces at home is extremely muted, and it's muted in the EU as well.
Is this an opportunity for the so-called new progressive Democrats that are on their way to Congress to carve out some space, differentiate themselves from Democratic leadership, and call to the attention of the American people that, again, Donald Trump is filling up your car and smoking at the gas station at the same time?
Yes, it would be an opportunity. I'm extremely skeptical that they will avail themselves of that opportunity. I mean, as you know, Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are much more comfortable discussing domestic policy than they are foreign policy. And Bernie Sanders has even, jumped at various points, has jumped on the anti-Russian bandwagon. So he's unlikely to take the lead on this issue. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in my opinion, is even more unlikely to get involved. So it's a bad situation, and I think the Democrats bear a great deal of a blame for the situation because they have tried to out-hawk Trump on Russia, and this is where they've wound up as a consequence.
That's, I think, a very, you've said that a couple of times, and that's a very important thing for people to understand here. We've discussed it on the show a number of times, is that the stereotype is that the Republicans or the slash conservatives are the hawkish party and that the Democrats slash liberals are the peace party. But what we find on the issue of international conflict is that the Democrats have been just as hawkish, if not more so, than Republicans, a la Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, or Senator Hillary Clinton voting for the war in the invasion of Iraq, which a whole lot of people did. But also, she was one of those masterminds behind the invasion of Libya, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. She was also backing the president's play on supporting Saudi Arabia and the war in Yemen. So for folks who want to think that the Democrats are doves, they sure look like hawks.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back even farther. It goes back to the war on drugs, which the Democrats championed in the 1980s, while Reagan was actually, much cooler on the topic. It goes back to Vietnam, of course. You know, where Eisenhower, refused to get involved, and JFK, threw himself into Vietnam, head first. So the Democrats, the idea of the Democrats being the peace party is highly misleading. It's much more complex than that. But certainly on the question of Russia, the Democrats have been highly aggressive over the last 2 years in trying to accusing Trump of being soft on Putin, in bed with Putin, on the take from Putin, Putin's puppet, as Hillary Clinton put it. And now they're speechless. They have nothing to say at all when Trump engages in these highly dangerous, maneuvers with regard to Russia. They are really dangerous. I mean, we could see a real arms race in this category, and it's not a good thing.
No, we can't afford it socially. We can't afford it financially. We can't afford it geopolitically. It's a bad move all the way around. In fact, this goes back to an adage that I've been saying for a number of years, is that you cannot engage in politics on the political expediency side on the front end and then try to claim the moral high ground on the back end. And it sounds as though the Democrats found a convenient trope in terms of attacking Russia, using that against the Republicans, and now they've backed themselves in a corner to where they can't take the principled stand on backing out of this treaty puts the entire world in peril.
No, it's a very bad thing. Politics in America, it's all expediency, right? There are no principles at all. It's like, these guys will do whatever, do whatever it takes to get elected. Principles principles are a distant thought.
Daniel Lazar, journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Thank you, Daniel, as always, for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.